I should ask you the questions. There are a couple of things, however, I'd like to say. One of them, this is probably as good a place as any in the world to quote Thomas Jefferson, but there is a Thomas Jefferson quote, which I've recalled many, many times throughout my career. It goes like this: the sum total of the common sense of the American people is the greatest force on earth. And as you go through these political campaigns, and as you become somewhat cynical about what's happening and the possibility that things may be turning a bit sour on us, you wonder whether that common sense factor is eroding a little bit or whether it can be maintained as the greatest force on earth. Now, one of the most memorable nights in my recollection occurred in the night of, or early morning hours, I should say, of November 7th, 1952. We were in Studio 41 in Grand Central Terminal, New York, one of the large rooms up over the terminal building. We had just finished what approximately amounted to 18 months of political campaigning, turmoil, plowing new ground because everything we did was new. Election night saw Eisenhower, of course, win by a fairly substantial margin over Adlai Stevenson. And as we were sitting around 4 o'clock in the morning in the studio, as the technicians were taking the walls down around us and moving the physical equipment out, we sat there and talked about the previous 18 months. And we really were jubilant. There was a feeling of euphoria that something had been accomplished that had never been accomplished in this country before. Television had moved in hard into a campaign, had made its mark. None of us knew quite in advance how it was all going to come out, because we were pioneering. But we thought that night that the accomplishments were very substantial. We thought, for example, that hereafter campaigns would run much shorter, that there'd be a reduction in the amount of campaign travel that the candidates would indulge in, that the level of the campaign would be raised substantially, that we'd encourage greater voter participation, that we'd end sham and charlatanism. We talked about the X-ray eye being able to see through sham and expose the inner man. We talked about the fact that voters hereafter would be better informed than they ever had been before because of this new medium, which would establish direct contact with the voters and permit the candidate to communicate much more directly, much more effectively than he ever had before. We were sure that it would guarantee better candidates because it would expose charlatanism and make the primary and convention systems work better. And it would reduce costs because it would reduce travel, reduce campaign time, and no longer make it necessary to spend all the money on campaign trains and big auditoriums and that kind of thing. But of course, all of us here know that it didn't happen that way. And the question is, what went wrong? Now, in retrospect, we can begin to see some things. It's evident that we were mesmerized by our own success, and at that point we were succumbing, totally succumbing to euphoria. But it's discouraging now to look at the results. The percentage of voters going to the polls did go up. It went up to reach a peak in 1960, something over 60% of American voters went to the polls. It's been declining ever since, and now it's down into around the 50% level. So this is a presidential election, so it didn't work the way we thought it would. Campaigns are not getting shorter, they're getting longer. The Michigan caucuses now take place in the fall of the preceding year, and the campaign really starts before the Michigan caucuses. Federal legislation has contributed to it by making it mandatory that there be some evidence of financial support in the coffers of the candidate prior to the beginning of the year of the campaign. The cost of getting elected has been going up exponentially. It's frightening how fast it's been going up, and it's far greater than the rise in the inflationary rates. The level of the campaign is surely not higher than it ever was before. In fact, there is genuine evidence to indicate that it's becoming more superficial and that it's more oriented to tricks, gimmicks, and now recently a new trend is negative campaigning. And of course, it's negative campaigning we've been seeing a lot of in Texas. travel has been increasing. It hasn't slowed down a bit. It's been increasing also in high multiples. Richard Nixon set the pace in 1960 when he vowed to visit all 50 of the states of the United States, which he did. Since then, travel has been picking up. Jim Hagerty, Eisenhower's press secretary in the 1952 campaign, introduced a new gimmick by the use of the aircraft. It was possible, for example, to cover three cities in one day. Eisenhower did that at the beginning of the fall campaign in 1952 and set the pattern. Now it's not at all unusual for a candidate to cover the East Coast in the morning, the West Coast in the afternoon, and pick up the Middle West on the way back to the East Coast that night, all the way across the country. Now, you do that three or four times a week, and your campaign budget goes up, and the travel budget goes up. The X-ray eye, obviously, has proved to be a total fraud. Almost anybody can still run for office, and the X-ray eye of the camera apparently is not an X-ray eye at all. I can't comment on the caliber of the candidates. It probably is no worse than it ever was, but also it'd be hard to find any proof that it's any better. I think there are additional hints that damage has been done. Party organizations, I think this is quite significant, national, state, and local, have clearly been losing power and influence. There's some question as to whether the party campaign or the national committee and the state and local committees have any real power at all anymore, or whether it's all been abdicated to the political professionals who now represent the candidates. Citizen participation, as opposed to voting, has been declining. It's been dropping precipitately. By citizen participation, I mean the people who come in and lick the envelopes or seal the envelopes and lick the stamps and place all the telephone calls and drive the cars going out and getting voters to the polls. That type of participation, there is good evidence, has been dropping. Professional campaign specialists, call them hired guns if you will, have been taking over a lot of the functions which used to be done by citizen participants. And now the political parties and volunteers are being replaced by the hired guns. Advertising agencies are being replaced by political consultants. Now the question, of course, is why are these changes occurring? It's easy to say, well, television is solely responsible. I don't think that's true, but it does play a part. But what's different about campaigning in 1990 or as will be in 1992? And what factors have changed since Governor Dewey ran against President Truman for the presidency back in 1948? You know, what new tools for campaigning are involved that were not present in that 1948 campaign? Now, there are many of them that are available now and that are being used now. Television is one of them. Jet aircraft are very important. The airlines didn't have the capacity, didn't have the speed to be able to accomplish in 1948 what they're able to do now. Many more airports in use, many more planes flying. Videotape recording is very important. Videotape recording was not introduced until 1957 and didn't become commonly used until the late 60s and 70s. So videotape recording has been a factor. Electrostatic copiers. I remember seeing the first electrostatic copier in the late 1950s. Now it's possible, instead of using carbon papers and mimeograph machines, to crank out copies of speeches and data in a tremendous rush. Computers. There were virtually no computers. As a matter of fact, we used the first computer ever used on election returns in 1952, a great big old UNIVAC, which probably has a lot less capacity and a lot less speed than a very small portable today. It covered a good part of an enormous room on 19th Street, North Philadelphia, the UNIVAC in 1952, but we projected election returns on it. Now computers are used for communications, generally by campaign managers. Portable electronic cameras have become tremendously important in covering campaigns. Satellites have played a part, because with satellites, now we have instant communications back and forth across the country, long distances and short. Now, before 1948, or through 1948, the campaigns were fought out in newspapers, on radio, on lecture platforms, on the rear platforms of whistle-stopping trains that meandered slowly across the countryside. Some of you may have read or written on a whistle-stopping train. I did in 1948 on both the Dewey and Truman trains for a couple of days. The campaigns were managed and directed by professional politicians and by dedicated volunteers. There were very few professionals as such. There were some beginning to work in politics, but largely on issues apart from candidate selection. The Whitaker and Baxter firm out in California was operating as a political consultant, but they weren't working on candidate campaigns. They were working on issues, on initiative and referendum. In California, since Hiram Johnson, you know, has been very strong in initiative and referendum, and we usually have at least 25 or 30 items on the ballot each year with a lot of money behind them. And political consultants actually got their start supporting these initiative and referendum issues. And of course, the National Committee, the volunteer, state and party organizations, volunteers, National Committee staff, advertising agencies, all played a part in carrying on the campaigns. Now, the campaign in the 80s and 90s bears very, very little relationship to what we saw back in 1948 and even at the beginning of 52. The whistle-stopping train, you know, it's still done some, but it's a curiosity. Somebody may use a whistle stop up through the Central Valley in California, for example, but as a novelty to attract attention. It's like some of these old historic railroad trains that are being put together for excursions. Maybe it's like the Oriental Limited, the same idea. It achieves its strength out of its novelty value. The formal campaign speech delivered in the auditorium, how many are done now? Virtually none. It used to be that the whistle-stop train would stop in a city. The candidate and the entourage would go to the auditorium. The speech would be made, be covered by radio, paid time on radio. They'd go back to the whistle-stop train and move on to the next city. That simply isn't done anymore. The hordes of campaign volunteers haven't totally evaporated. Someone still has to seal those envelopes and lick those stamps. Somebody's still got to drive those cars to get people to the polls. But by and large, you don't see the hordes of the young, aggressive volunteers who traveled with Gene McCarthy, for example, in 1968. It doesn't happen. And the once powerful political parties, for the most part, are left sucking their thumbs in the corner while the political pros take over the job. Now, television is only one of the new technological wonders that plays a significant role, but it's clearly the most significant one. I think one of the reasons it's significant is the fact that it overlaps so many of these others. So many of the others are designed primarily to aid the coverage by television and to be able to create an environment in television which is conducive to the support of the candidate. The consequence, the campaign has been trivialized. The change becomes apparent when the television news of the 52 campaign is contrasted with the television campaigns in the late 1980s, for example, as we'll go on to 1992. That 52 campaign was really the first one covered by television. We didn't have much to work with at that time. There were only 108 television stations in the country. The total number of television homes as that campaign began was about 17 million. The penetration was somewhere around 25 to 30% of American homes. It was impossible to transmit a signal across the country on more than one loop. In other words, only one network at a time could cross from east to west. And in many parts of the country, there simply was only one microwave loop. Jet aircraft were simply not existent except in certain sophisticated military roles. Airports were few in number. The reporters we were using then were mostly veterans of the war. They'd come out of radio, and as war veterans, they were accustomed to doing 90-second, 120-second, two-and-a-half-minute roundups, but very little immediacy. Most of it was thoughtful and analytical-type reporting. Most of them had solid newspaper experience, and they were good reporters and quite serious-minded individuals. Another reason for using that type of reporting is the fact that we were dependent then on 16-millimeter film cameras, which were really amateur cameras, for any pictorial coverage. In New Hampshire, for example, there were no airports that were functioning that could get our film back to New York. The only 16-millimeter labs in operation in the New England area were Boston or New York. So we send the reporters up with film crews. The reporters, for the most part, were accustomed to analytical-type coverage. The film cameras couldn't possibly get anything done and get it back to New York with less than a 24-hour delay. So as a consequence, the report we were laying down in the 1 15-minute news program at night, the Doug Edwards in the News, was a very serious, thoughtful, analytical type of coverage of that political campaign. That pretty well characterized the 1952 coverage. There were no jets, no videotape, no satellites, no portable electronic cameras that would capture the item right on the spot. And we had to go through this whole complicated process. The result, there's no immediacy, 24-hour delays. Emphasis was on the thoughtful and the analytical. Now, contrast that with the present. The 108 stations in the country at that time has gone up to more than 1,000, including the VHFs and the some LP TVs and the public television stations, well over 1,000 altogether. The 30% penetration of 1952 is increased to pretty much saturation. There are very few homes without television. The one big television set in the home is going up to an average of 2.5 to 3 in the home at this stage. The videotape recorders now not only are in studios, but they're carried over the shoulders so you can record on the spot. The electronic camera hooked into a videotape recorder and turned into a satellite uplink makes it possible to transmit instantly live to any point within the whole continental United States, or for that matter, anywhere around the world. And something else has happened. The hours on the air is increased. When we started this business, the networks devoted, the two major networks, well, I guess all three. There were four networks at that time, also the Dumont Television Network, which didn't have any news, but the other three were doing 15 minutes each night. Our 15 minutes was back-to-back with Perry Como for a 7:30 to 8 o'clock hour at Eastern Time. With that little time on the air, there really wasn't time to do very much. The stations had not yet discovered a secret, and the secret they hadn't discovered is that you can make money out of news broadcasting. They, at that time, for the most part, I can't generalize and say everybody, but for the most part, they assumed that what they were doing was building goodwill in the community and building a good record in the FCC's good books so that at license renewal time, they could point to the fact that they were delivering a lot of public service, and news was public service. So there really wasn't much time. But then the hours on the air increased. It didn't really jump until the middle 1960s when the networks went to a half hour. At that time, the stations were many more in number. When the networks went to a half hour, many of them had programmed the other 15 minutes with local news. Now, against a half hour, they had to program at least a half hour. And some stations began to find that there's enough money to be made out of it, so let's go to the hour. Stations now are doing, many of them are doing 2 hours of news in the evening, another half hour, 11 o'clock at night, a half hour at noon. They're filling in the five-minute spots in the morning shows on the networks, and some are doing even more, including weekends. So the 15 minutes at the maximum of the 50s has gone to 2, 3, 4 hours. Now, as you increase the number of stations from 108 to an excess of 1,000, as you increased the number of hours in the air from a quarter hour up to 2, 3, and 4 hours, there was an enormous demand for personnel. There was no place, no reservoir of talent from which to derive that personnel. So they had to go out and look for personnel, inexperienced, untrained personnel, to fill in these required spots in the air. In the process of doing so, they had to take personnel who didn't have the standards, the quality, the experience that we'd been using in that early political coverage. And something else was happening simultaneously. As the stations began to find that there was money to be made, they began to place a lot more reliance on ratings. Also, as the other stations, the competing stations, began to contest for ratings with them, the dollar value of a rating point got to the point, got up to the level where it became required in order to keep your head above water financially, to begin to look for gimmicks, look for devices, look for audience-grabbing tools that would make it possible to keep those ratings up. I think this, in many respects, led to the employment of actors who weren't necessarily reporters, to women who were more interested in the coiffure than they were in the experience and in the competence as broadcasters. It led to the creation of the anchorman who sat in the studio and looked good and read well rather than the person who was out in the field reporting. And as a consequence, news on the air, to my mind, in many cases, became trivialized. Now let's bring in one other factor. The candidates saw this happening. In 1952, most of them were quite concerned about the rise of television. I remember the battle we had with both the national committees, trying to find space in the national convention halls to put our cameras. It was much more important to a Republican National Committee to have 16 seats in a box in the international amphitheater at the in the stockyards in Chicago. If we took the 16 seats, 16 faithful Republicans would be taken out of the opportunity of sitting in those favored seats. So we had to fight that battle. They were much more interested in taking care of their favored few than they were in us. The Republicans in 1952 actually turned us down on a center camera platform. We didn't have a center camera platform. As a consequence, we could take only quarter profile shots. And also, if we did try to use a head-on shot from way back at the back with the long lenses we had then, you'd see that wavering in the face, and we couldn't get a solid shot. So the Republicans actually looked pretty bad for the most part during that convention. Well, then they switched over completely. By 1956, they'd gone entirely the opposite direction. By then, they saw this as their opportunity to make a big show out of it, a pageant, a demonstration to the public how wonderful they were. So by that time, they were not only asking us to come in, but they were demanding that we do certain things they wanted. For example, the Democrats produced a film, a half-hour film. They got a young senator from Massachusetts named Kennedy to narrate the film. And they were furious. I said, I'm not going to take it, and refused to take it. We turned. We did other things then, and finally, from time to time, we'd come in and show that the audience was in a darkened hall watching a screen. We considered that being the news, but Paul Butler, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, was absolutely furious that here we had refused to carry part of the convention. Well, that marked a complete change in attitude, and from that point on, television became a tool of the political managers and the candidates rather than an independent reporting source on its own. And of course, it aided and abetted to some extent. Well, you carry on, we come to the next and the last stage, and that is that up until this time, the political amateurs, or call them semi-pros, I guess, were running campaigns, but now the consultant comes on the scene. The advertising agencies had done a lot of it for some time, but the advertising agencies were much busier selling soap and cereals and Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola and couldn't really take the time off once every 4 years or once every 2 years for a political campaign. So they were quite willing to abdicate. But the consultants, the political managers, the real professionals began to come in. They began to see that in television they had a wonderful opportunity to promote their candidates to the absolute hilt. Now, these political consultants had tremendous advantages over the personnel in the stations. I pointed out that the personnel in many of the stations were much less sophisticated than the rather hard-bitten old-timers who had come in from radio and newspapers much earlier, and much more inclined to the gee whiz attitude, I've got a chance to interview a candidate, and this is wonderful, it gives me a chance to hobnob with the rich and the important and the public leaderships. So the political consultants had a natural field. They were highly sophisticated, they were specialists, they understood television, they had studied it, they knew the interests of the public, and could cater to those interests of the public. And significantly, they had time to plan the events, the surefire events, to capture the attention of the camera. And this, of course, is something that the overworked television news staff didn't have the opportunity to do. So, as a consequence, station news personnel, who didn't have the time to plan ahead in detail, were too concerned with mechanics to give much thought to planning. They were really less sophisticated than the consultants. They were less knowledgeable about issues because they were generalists, they weren't specialists, they had many reporting duties to perform. So they had less sophistication. At the same time, television had gone in an interesting direction. It had started thinking in terms of memorable moments. You know, a single picture or sequence packed full of high emotion, of pathos, joy, the kind of a moment that you'll remember. Then they also had discovered sound bites. Now, the sound bite isn't really anything new. A sound bite is simply they were filming some things I said out there a little while ago. Now, not all of that will go on the air, but they'll pick a few bites out of it if I was smart enough to put in a few bites. And I don't know whether I was or not. But the sound bite simply is a 15, 20, 30 second piece of film that you isolate out to use in some kind of a program. It really isn't any different from Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death. It's a great soundbite. Nathan Hale's I Regret That I Have But One Life to Live for My Country. Or Herbert Hoover, who wishes probably he had never gotten involved in saying his soundbite, the chicken in every pot and two cars in every garage. But in the 1980s, though, sound bites were refined to a very high level. There are even persons who make a living, not make a full living, but will write sound bites professionally, so they give to a candidate. So we've got something entirely new. They were used to great advantage by George Bush in 1988, I think to somewhat lesser advantage by Michael Dukakis. All you have to do is remember No New Taxes, Read My Lips, which is a soundbite which gained credence and people are still repeating it. You heard Lloyd Benson say, "You're no Jack Kennedy, Senator." That was a soundbite which was picked up and went all over. The The rating wars and the profits that go with them make the soundbite an attractive commodity to the stations, but the networks are not at all immune. You remember the Betsy Ross Museum episode with George Bush. George Bush had to prove his patriotism, so he went to the Betsy Ross Museum and almost literally wrapped himself in a flag and made some memorable statement to be able to establish the Willie Horton soundbites, you remember. George Bush commenting on pollution while he was aboard the boat out in Boston Harbor created some sound bites. Unfortunately, Michael Dukakis didn't create quite the atmosphere in that ridiculous tank man's uniform in the battle tank. It's pretty difficult to create anything memorable there. And they hauled him all the way out to Yellowstone Park to look at a burning tree, which they probably could have found in a fireplace somewhere. But it's that's an effort of consultants to create sound bites. Now, my concern is that we've gotten to the level where the sound bites will permit campaigns to be built around episodes like the Willie Horton innuendos, which takes the play completely away from any rational approach on the issue of parole, for example, and imprisonment, and puts it into an innuendo instead. I don't blame the television stations for it necessarily. Really, it's the consultants who come up with the idea, and the television stations accept it and use it. And we create an atmosphere that I think is damaging. If that's the kind of substance in which voters make the decisions, then we're in deep trouble. So on balance, I'm afraid the television has done a disservice to the American political campaign, not so much by what it's done as perhaps by what isn't done, it hasn't done, and by its subservience in many respects. It's not subservience necessarily, but its reliance on the political campaigners and their hired guns who produce the information and the evidence. The political leaders are bending the medium to their ends, and I think in that case the public is the loser. I just hope that Thomas Jefferson was absolutely right, that the subtotal of the common sense of the American public is the greatest force on earth, and even though we're subjected to some campaigning which we wish we didn't have to be, I sincerely hope that the good sense, the judgment of the American people will be able to sustain it, we'll get back on the solid ground.
We're especially pleased that Mrs. Mickelson could be with us too and take part in our discussion if she wishes. Who'd like to ask the first question? Colonel Foster?
It's a cliche that nations get the government that they deserve. And on that type of reasoning, is it our fault that we accept these things that you've just been criticizing? Our fault, the American people's fault for accepting this?
Well, I guess it is so far, yes. It's the trouble is that I suppose the real level of high sophistication, the number of persons with a high level of sophistication is relatively few. And if it is possible for the political campaign to emphasize those elements which have the maximum degree of salesmanship in them, they will appeal to a very large percentage of the total population. And therefore, I think your hypothesis is correct, that we're putting ourselves into a position of accepting a level of politics which we should resist.
Yes.
Would you care to Mr. comment Gordon. On the development and the influence of the polls, please?
Well, I don't think it's the development of the polls that is subject to any adverse criticism. I think it's the use being made of the polls. And from two points of view, I suppose political candidates have permitted themselves to become much too subservient to polling and much too willing to bend to the whims of the public, which are demonstrated in the constant use of these polls. Secondly, I think the media, and I'm not accepting newspapers and radio and magazines, probably are putting too much credence in the polls, and they're not doing enough to qualify their usages of them. Now, the poll, as you all know, is only an indicator of what may be true at any given time. It's still subject to a certain amount of interpretation. And the tendency of the media is to convert these polls too much into odds on a horse race. And you give it an absolute quality, which they don't really deserve. It seems to me that what we need is more sophisticated use of the polling techniques by the media, and perhaps a little less firm reliance on the part of the candidates. And the polls themselves, I think, are very useful devices.
Next question. David Broder has suggested that one of the possible avenues for change might be to reason that the voters pay for the campaign in checkoff arrangements. Therefore, they ought to have some opportunity to specify what kind of discussions go on. And he's played with the idea that perhaps you could require a certain number of, not the kinds of debates we've had, but more serious discussion, an hour's discussion with a candidate, something of that kind.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. The debate situation, I know very well, having sat through all of the negotiations on those first 1960 debates. We came into those so-called debates convinced that what we should have is what the debate coaches will call the Oregon style of debate, in which the affirmative speaks, the negative speaks, or one candidate, then the other. There are rebuttals, and then there's cross-examination. A candidate A by B and B by A, and then finally summations at the end. Now, this would be a real debate. And at that point, I think they would be forced to elucidate their ideas about the campaign. I think they'd be forced to take it seriously. At that point, I was never convinced personally that the candidates were actually going to accept that Kennedy and Nixon were ever going to step into the ring together. I thought that if we get through certain stages, they could, one or the other could always pull out at the last minute. So we were inclined to be a little more subservient than I think we had to be. But it finally came down to a meeting in the Mayflower Hotel on, I think, September 1st, 1960, at which the issue was to be resolved. We came in prepared to take a firm stand, but we knew that we wanted them badly, and we knew that our managements wanted them badly. At one point where we were at an absolute impasse, the representatives of the two candidates asked us to leave the room and stand out in the hall for a while while they made up their minds whether they were going to accept our terms. We got back in again about 15 minutes later, not knowing quite where we stood, but they had by this time come up with a complete plan, and most of it conformed to what we wanted to do, except they outlined this plan for statements. I think it was 8 minutes opening statements from each, a certain amount of examination by a group of reporters on the floor, and then concluding summary statements. But we decided, in the interest of getting these things on the air, making the whole system of debates work, to go ahead and accept it. They said that would be the first debate and the final debate. The second and third debates would be only examination by a panel of reporters. We finally accepted, and they went on the air on that basis. I wish now that we hadn't. I wish we'd blown the whole thing. Because what happened is that there's been a degradation of the debate system ever since. It's gotten out of the point now where it's no debate at all. It's a collection of sound bites stimulated by reporters. And of course, there's no compulsion on the part of the candidate to answer the reporter's question. All he has to do is find something else to talk about, and even with a follow-up question, you still can't nail the candidate down. So, yes, I would like to see serious debates, as they were originally envisioned, as we campaigned for debating during the 1950s. I'm not sure we're going to get them.
Next question. Yes, Bill Wemple.
I'm sorry, but you have an earlier question.
Okay, Louise Fernbach.
I was just wondering if you thought of anything that could be done to reverse this trend of becoming ever more trivial and getting it to the point where we go into the news in more depth and into the political issues in greater depth. Is there any process that anybody could indulge in to bring this about?
Yeah, I was very impressed. I went to a meeting of the Radio Television News Directors Association out of Kansas City last September. They had a forum on this political question, and there was a woman news director from a Kansas City station who described her attitude and how she had handled situations. She said the a candidate for the Senate, for example, came up to the station at 5 minutes to 6 one night and said, "I'm ready to go on the air." And she said, "Sorry, Mr. Senator," or whatever he was, "unfortunately, our rundown for the show is complete. We don't have a spot available. Let us know in advance next time when you might make yourself available. We'll see what we can do." This took real courage on her part. You know, the normal tendency is to say, "Oh, I've got a chance to get a big name, it'll get audience." She said, "No, get lost." And it seems to me if more directors of news will take that point of view, if the news executives will get tougher and more insistent, more demanding on some kind of standards, that yes, there is a possibility for improvement.
Next question, Bill Wemple.
Why wouldn't the old-fashioned campaign speech from each on prime time, not in any necessarily the same night, as a policy of the media be at least as good, as I would think a lot better, than those what they call debates that I think are almost laughable?
Well, back to 1960, we offered each of the candidates 4 free hours of time on the air, provided they would go into these debates in a realistic debate on a realistic debate plan. They, at that time, turned down the 4 free hours on the air. We said that it had to be by our format because we didn't feel that we were in a position to give away the complete hour for them to do exactly what they wanted to with it. But if they had accepted, and the format would have been quite relaxed, would have been quite loose, they could have made use of that hour essentially for a presentation of that type.
But why not let them just make their own speech? The other side can point out what they left out, what they allegedly misrepresented, and so on and so on. Why insist that the candidate has to bind himself to face these media people and be cross-examined? I can see why the managers would say, "No, don't get into that. Don't do that."
We're into a matter of economics now, economics and ratings. An hour of nighttime, hour of Class A time, has an enormous value attached to it. And not only does it have that enormous value attached to it, but an hour of a political speech will erode the time on both sides. In other words, it'll cut the lead-in time, so reduced income there, it'll cut the lead-out time, so there's reduced income there. So the cost of doing it is very substantial. The amount of audience one would get for an old-fashioned, straight political speech at this point, up against all of the other media which are available to entertain at that time, would be virtually nil. It'd be very, very little, except the faithful followers. The trouble is that might have worked in the 1950s, when there weren't any competing media. There were just television stations and networks. However, now you've got VCRs. You go down to the corner VCR store, and you've got all the cable, the 36 up to 62, 76, or almost 100 cable channels. So you have all the competing factors. And the question is whether anybody, any network, which is, the networks are struggling economically anyway at the moment, whether they should be asked to make that kind of a concession, and whether they should assume that much burden of cost, even though it might serve the public interest. At the same time, how much does it serve the public interest if the viewership, listenership is very, very limited at that time? It's a dilemma, and I'm not sure how to answer that one.
Tom Sorensen.
Actually, my question related to this. One big difference from 60 and 52, of course, is the proliferation of news sources. We have CNN now and C-SPAN, yeah. and public television has an hour news every night in the middle with long interviews and so on. Does this change the equation? Does it make it better? Does it make it worse?
I think it changes the equation for the better. One thing that I have been disturbed about in the past is that public television in the past has not done as much as it can. It exists largely for that purpose, I think. But I think between C-SPAN and public television, we've got a real opportunity for the future. C-SPAN is really magnificent. It's amazing. And I'm surprised at the number of viewers C-SPAN has. I've had some personal experience with it. I did an hour with Brian Lamb once last October, I guess, and it went on the air for the first time sometime in early January. And then I don't know how many times they've repeated it since, but I'm amazed at the number of persons from all over the country who has saw that and one or another of its reincarnations. But I think there we have some enormous resources. And rather than ask the commercial television networks, I think the resource lies in public television and C-SPAN. Public television was very slow getting into political coverage, because there were prohibitions, barriers against it in many states. And the question whether the national law creating CPB really permitted it or not. But public television has become much more aggressive since that time. It can afford to give away free time, and it's doing it. It can afford to set up real debates and tell a person, a candidate, if you want time on the air, you come into it. We're setting the format for you, and here it is. If you don't want to drop out, get lost. So you've got the answer to much of it.
Is there any risk that public television, McNeil Air being an example, is obsessed with this notion of conflict, having opposites, sometimes extreme opposites, and does that help in the education of the American public?
Well, that's one of those facts of life, I guess, that anybody, unfortunately, public television has had to keep its eye on the rating books. In order to justify itself, it's had to do that to a limited extent, but it has. And I don't know how they could do otherwise. C-SPAN can and does. So you run into that inevitable conflict. But at the same time, I think there's a possibility of hitting some kind of a middle ground. And I think public television, to a considerable extent, is doing it. It does stimulate a certain amount of conflict. I've seen public television stations, for example, bring in debate and run it as real debate and get conflict out of it. In so doing, they've had to prevent the Socialist Labor Party and the Socialist Workers Party and the Greenbacks Party and the Prohibition Party also to come in, and it's pretty dull stuff, and they waste an hour or so doing it. But they've been willing to do it. And more honor to them as a result.
Other questions, Michael?
The LA Times did a poll after the November 1988 election, and they asked people how many recognized the name Willie Horton. It was about 1 in 4.
Yeah.
Now, Willie Horton didn't have anything to do with the 88 election. Willie Horton became famous with all this talk about what's wrong with the media. The Gannett Center for Media Studies did a computer analysis. I hope they did in 1988. I think they knew who the two candidates were. I think the people who stayed at home knew why they were staying at home. I don't see what the problem is.
I think one of the problems is 25%. 25% is not an infinitesimal figure. That's a pretty substantial figure. 25% recognized Willie Horton. I think that indicates that it took a solid hold.
Well, that's people who recognized his name. That doesn't mean that they voted because of it.
No. It doesn't mean that at all. I didn't mean that they voted because of Willie Horton. What I'm saying is it creates an attitude. It creates an atmosphere. And it creates an atmosphere of innuendo rather than an atmosphere based upon any solid argument.
Other questions? Mrs. Elliott.
That sort of brings us into the discussion of the PACs and influence and the single issue groups and influences on campaigns.
Yes. And there, I think television also is guilty of a disservice. In giving too much issue to the single issue, the single issue supporters. That became obvious way back from the very beginning of television. We were going from one issue to another and being completely subservient to whatever the issue of the day was. And unfortunately, there's a weakness in the television camera. And that is that the human eye has a wide range of vision and it has the ability to shift without a cameraman telling it to shift. And as you have some of these demonstrations on the Capitol steps, and the little core group, for example, in the center, is doing something very exciting and creating a tremendous amount of commotion. And the camera, of course, is focused tightly in there, and if it would just pan 10 degrees off to the side, it would see that nobody is paying the slightest bit of attention to it. And that is a weakness, and it's a weakness not only of the camera, but of the director and the cameraman who operate it. And I think it's a weakness that we have to watch.
We've heard from no one, so far as I know, under 40. Dan, do you have a question?
I object to that.
Well, you're precocious.
Okay. Well, the only question I had was that if 25% of the people know who Willie Horton is and we only have 50% of the people voting, then up to 50% of the people affecting the outcome would be apprised of that soundbite. Possibly. I mean, that's playing with statistics a little bit. But
yeah, I don't follow that math at all.
if one quarter of the people know who Willie Horton is, and only 50% of the people in the country are voting for the presidential elections, then possibly a substantially greater percentage than just 25% of those people who are determining the outcome. I mean, it could be very much.
Well, all right. I need a blackboard to show you where the logical flaws are.
Nothing that we like better than to have a good graduate student tackle a confident assistant professor.
Well, I was going to say is that that 25% might not have voted at all. Mm-hmm. So
Next, other questions? Al Fernbach.
I'm glad to join the 39 and holding. I wondered whether another factor isn't the decline in the ability of candidates to effectively debate. I think while we have an occasional one, like the senator from Texas, who's pretty sharp, we have less than we had 40 or 50 years ago of the spontaneous ability to come with the quip and the put the finger on the crucial point.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that we have had candidates who would have been competent to debate in the past. I think In 1948, Dewey was a superb debater. Harold Stassen was cut up to the ribbons of Oregon in a radio debate. And Harold Stassen wasn't a bit bad either against any other kind of opposition. I think Stevenson could have been very effective on the debate platform. I'm not sure that Eisenhower would have been. Kennedy and Nixon. Nixon might have been the greatest of the whole lot if he hadn't been frightened to death, apparently, going up against Kennedy that night in 1960. And I suppose that since that time, we haven't had anybody very effective. But maybe if there were greater interest in debate, maybe we'd be picking candidates who could stand up on the lesser platform of debate.
You've said some things about common carrier in the past. Is there anything you could tell us about that kind of a idea? Media is common carrier.
Well, you mean which media would be common carriers?
Yes.
Well, the reason for getting into this common carrier question is the fact that there is a new element being introduced into communications to the individual now, and that's the telephone companies. And the telephone companies are quickly getting into a position where there will be enough fiber optics so that they'll be able, I suppose within a decade or so, to go directly into the home with fiber optics. I don't know how deeply I should get into it. But if they are able to install fiber and go to the home with it, fiber will carry almost an infinite number of telephone conversations and pretty close to an infinite number of video signals directly into the home, which will give you a vast range in the home. The telephone companies currently, and when I say the telephone companies, I'm lumping up seven regional bell operating companies into one, which I shouldn't do. There are variations in attitude. But generally, what they would like to do is free themselves of the constraints imposed by the modified final judgment of Judge Green in 1983, which restricts them from originating information which they carry on their lines. In other words, they can carry only messages which are originated by someone outside the telephone company. And that, in a sense, is a common carrier principle, although it's only in a sense. Now, the common carrier becomes important because historically, the common carrier principle has suggested that if you are delivering grain in a boxcar or delivering oil in a tank or in a tank car or by a pipeline, or if you're delivering Federal Express by airplane, you're under certain restrictions. In other words, you have to ensure that you'll deliver the material, and you've got to ensure that you will not discriminate against any possible user. It doesn't necessarily protect you from carrying goods that you yourself manufacture. Now, this is the common carrier principle. As it's being applied currently, it prevents the telephone companies from delivering information they create, programming information, for example. The telephone companies are arguing now that until they get the privilege to deliver their own information that they create, they don't want to invest the money to deliver fiber to the home. Now, if they get that permission, which they're seeking, the first thing we'll see will be electronic yellow pages, for example. And the electronic yellow pages will come up on a screen attached to your telephone, as it does in France now with the Minitel system, of which there are now 5 million units in France. And at the same time, they might begin to originate or edit and distribute news and information. They might even buy syndicated motion pictures or syndicated television programs and feed them into the home, into your television receiver, or into the screen attached to your telephone. Now, this is where the common carrier principle is rather interesting, because it can upset many of these relationships currently existing among the various communications media.
Any other, Victor Yonke?
Mine isn't a question, but it's a comment.
maybe you'd like to make a comment on it. For quite a long time, a decade or more, I've been really concerned about the age group, seniors of high school, could be undergraduates, witnessing these political campaigns, these sound bites, the trivialization of the political system. It really undermines the peace of people that are teaching in universities. And they said, how can you really honestly teach the political system? It's one of integrity and decency and all that. And we're going to be exposed to this. I mean, we lose a whole generation of people between 18 to 22, 24 years of age. We really do.
I can't comment and say I agree.
You can't offer any kind of solution, perhaps?
Well, you know, we've had some suggested solutions. I think more attention paid to C-SPAN, more attention and research and resources given to public broadcasting, more emphasis put on or more pressures exerted on broadcasters, not governmental legislation or regulation, but public pressures on them to take a more serious view toward it. Some restraints imposed on candidates to get back to more fundamentals again. I think there are ways of doing it, but I don't think there's any one key that's going to unlock the whole thing all at once.
Is it impossible to have what some of us grew up with? I've spent a lot more time on basketball courts and football fields than I did in serious work in the classroom, but as a high school student. But I got a lot of my education along Victor's line from listening to Edward R. Murrow and Elmer Davis and Eric Severide on these longer commentaries. I remember taking notes on it. I remember when I began teaching, taking notes and using it in the classroom. It'd be interesting what Dan would say. Is our current equivalent the McNeil Lair program, or what? How often do you listen to McNeil Lair?
Well, I
you're not quite that young.
No.
But Dan,
I think
answer.
It's very valuable. I think the most couple of the more valuable sources, the written medium is often underplayed amidst all of the emphasis on television. But the Brinkley News Hour and the McNeil Lair are some of the more extensive and thoughtful, but I don't know. I would agree with Professor Cornfield in that I'm not sure that TV has trivialized it as much as people may think, because you know for the past several decades, I guess, and earlier than that, I mean, H.L. Mencken was criticizing the American campaign process a long time ago. And then all you have to do is look at the first administration of this country to see what sort of heckling went on. So I'm not sure whether we have a monopoly on it now. But,
are we exaggerating?
No, I think I commented on that to the effect that generally, I suppose historically, our campaigns are better than much better than they were in the 19th century, for example. The only thing is, the frustrating element is we've got so much better communications now, but I'm frustrated by the fact that we're not getting the maximum benefit out of all these communications we have. It's not that it's worse, but it just isn't as much better as it ought to be.
Any other questions?
Two questions on that. What's the incentive for the political parties to try to change? They've sort of been successful as they are. And also, who's going to enforce the new rules that we want to place? The radio stations, obviously, they make money. They're not there to provide the services free, I'm sure, and I mean they could be forced to, but I don't see the incentive. I don't see the enforcement of it.
Well, the Democrats have got a lot of incentive. No, they might be able to, or might stand in good stead for them to come up with some new system, some new device, some new way of winning back some of the support again.
That could well be.
Maybe it's time for some of these political strategists to start thinking in a different vein as to how you accomplish the election results.
Yes, Mr. Seaver.
Because television is ratings oriented, doesn't the audience get what it's asked for?
Yeah, to a certain extent, but it's ratings oriented, but then you can't say that it started with the public and the public said, this is what I want. They're given certain things and they're asked for preferences. So the argument that they're given exactly what they want is not necessarily wholly true. And you can, it is possible to elevate taste. You know, taste doesn't have to stay at the same level forever. You can lead. You may not be able to lead by very much, but you can lead by a little bit and keep on leading. And some of that, it seems to me, is necessary. Maybe we're going to get it with this proliferation of different media, which are now coming into play. You know, television really is over, or commercial television, as we've known it, is really over the peak. It's on its way down. Statistically, in 20 years ago, the television networks sets and use figure ran around 95%. Now it's down to around 65 and still dropping. The economy is beginning to drop off. The other media are beginning to move in. Maybe becoming more serious might bring back some of that audience. But I don't think you can do it by government order, by government restriction, by legislation, by regulation. I think it's got to be done. One answer, of course, is we get back to the high schools again. Are the high schools really teaching government and making government interesting, fascinating, to the point where you get excited about it? There's probably some weakness somewhere in the school system.
Any other questions? Well, we were sure Mr. Mickelson would excite and stimulate the specialists. We were sure he would excite and educate the rest of us, and I think he's done that, as I've seen him do it on other occasions. And all one can say is that when somebody has the courage in whatever field he's in to stand a little bit against the tide and move it even a few centimeters, why, that, it seems to me, is as much as anything as anybody can expect of us. So we're proud to have had Sig Mickelson with us.